Welcome to Shorts Season 3. I'm Jen Thomas. I live in New York City.
And I'm Lizzie Falconer, and I live in Portland, Oregon.
We are two long-distance friends who want to talk about what we're reading.
This podcast is about how reading short stories can show the world through different perspectives.
Today we're reading Taylor Swift, a piece of flash fiction by Hugh Bem Steinberg. Taylor Swift was the 2015 Barthelme winner for fiction. Hugh Bem Steinberg is a poet and short fiction writer. He's released several books of poetry, three chapbooks, and two libretti. Taylor Swift was published by Gulf Coast Mag. We've linked the story in the show notes.
In the alternative reality of the story, our narrator buys several Taylor Swift clones who are set to work doing chores and working out. Through this very short piece of fiction, the narrator uses the clones to deal with their emotions over their next-door neighbor and friend, Tina. Okay, Jed, let's get into this weird, weird little story.
Strap in, folks. Is this the weirdest story we've ever read?
I think so. It has to be. I mean, the heart in the house was weird, lovingly. This is a completely different level of weird. The narration, the size of the piece, how little we know about the world except for a few key odd bits. I don't know. It's a wild ride.
It really is. And this is, if you haven't read the story, this is a piece of flash fiction, and it'll take you about 2 minutes maximum to read the story. It is very, very short. Lizzie, do you want to remind people what a flash is?
Yeah, a piece of flash fiction is usually under 1,000 words. It's a really small, it takes the whole genre of short stories and moves it down even smaller, compacting the themes and the power of the story into even less space on a page.
And this story is very, very short. It's the flashiest of flashes. It's very, very short. And you talked about power of this story. This story really packs it in.
It does. I think the best way to frame this story is from a quote I found from Brandon Williams in the Master's Review talking about this story. And he said, "When we think of teachable stories, we often reach deep into the rucksack of the literary past, pulling out classroom-tested stories that have worked their way into the canon. While there's obviously a ton to learn from these pieces, contemporary short story writers are also completing strong work built upon teachable literary foundations, while also finding fascinating ways to advance the form." And I think that's done here. It's an unsettling story, but it's different.
Yeah, it really is. And obviously, as we'll know from the title, this story centers around Taylor Swift. And we are in a world where you can mail order Taylor Swift clones to come and live with you and sort of do anything that you could imagine asking someone to do for you. And we first read this story a couple of years ago, and I reread it in preparation for this episode, and I have a very different reaction to when I first read the story. I think because of what's been happening kind of in our popular culture around Taylor Swift specifically, who is now obviously kind of one of the biggest, if not the biggest, kind of most recognizable star in the world, and also what's happening in terms of the rise of technologies and artificial intelligence and that becoming a lot more mainstream. And so this story, even though it's really incredibly short, is somehow pushing on so many buttons for 2024, and it was written back in 2015.
Yeah, it feels somehow even more relevant now in 2024 with the conversation around Taylor Swift than it did in 2015. And we're going to get into that along with the stylistic choices. And I think we'll start out by saying that I am, in fact, wearing my Taylor Swift Eras Tour shirt. I am a fan of Taylor Swift, have been for a long time since I first listened to her music. And I think I'm more of a fan than you are. Is that true, Jen?
I think that's 100% true. I'm wearing a lovely green sweater that I was given for Christmas that has no Taylor Swift iconography of any kind on it. And I think if I was really hard pressed, I could name maybe three of her songs.
Oh, okay.
I'm kind of into Taylor Swift, the brand, like Taylor Swift, the icon, oh. Taylor Swift, the feminist sort of empowered woman. But Taylor Swift, the artist, I feel like I hardly know you. I hardly know you, Taylor.
Okay, well, I'm going to send you the Evermore and Folklore albums after this. I have very specific recommendations. But yeah, we will be talking about Taylor Swift along with this story, because at the center of this story is Taylor Swift. And of course, it's also the idea of celebrity and what happens when you get manufactured, when you become yourself a commodity. So let's get into it.
This story starts with a real bang. The first line is, "You're in love." So already, like, we've got a second person narrative, and we're starting with this incredibly powerful, powerful statement. And then we just immediately go on to the most wild, wild tangent I've ever seen. "You're in love. It's great. You swipe on your phone and order. The next day, a Taylor Swift clone shows up at your house. It's not awkward. It's everything you want. She knows all her songs and she sings them just for you." Great.
Wild.
So this story centers us in this world. There is no explanation to why or how you can get these clones. There's no idea if it's possible to get clones of anyone else.
Yeah.
So, but without any explanation or excuse, the author is just telling us, these are the things you need to know about the world. And then leads us into this world.
Yeah. And when I first read that first line, "You're in love, it's great," I thought the narrator was in love with the Taylor Swift clones. And I kind of didn't understand till, you know, a couple paragraphs that actually he's in love with his neighbor, Tina, and these clones are a way to get her attention.
And also in that first paragraph, we learn that Tina is having sex with her other Taylor Swifts. So Tina also has a collection of Taylor Swift clones. Tina seems to have many. And there's some of them she is having sex with. And the author writes, "They're so fucking loud, it's disgusting. You hate Taylor Swift." So by the end of that first paragraph, we go from "you're in love" to "you hate Taylor Swift. You've bought a clone. We've discovered this thing about the neighbor, Tina." And the idea of the kind of world that we're in with these Taylor Swifts starts to get pretty scary, I thought, from this idea that she's that the neighbor is just having sex with these clones and has other ones that are being kept on a perch. There's one that has wings. This ulterior world of Taylor Swift's are being used in all of these different ways by Tina, who is also the person this narrator is in love with.
Yeah, immediate sinister undertones. It brings up so many questions too. How much does a clone cost? Does everybody have Taylor Swift clones? Also, they're clones, not robots. So they're people. They're genetically, that was what I kept thinking about, was like, these are genetically similar to Taylor Swift, but then they know all of her songs. Like, are they robots? How are they programmed? What free will? I get, it starts to creep me out instantly.
Yeah. And in the second paragraph, I think we learn a little bit more, because we realize the narrator says, "You hate Taylor Swift. So you wake up the Taylor Swift clone and you start making her do the chores." And she asks, the clone says, "Why are you being so mean to me?" So this is someone who is able to witness and kind of process that someone is being mean to them. And this is where the story then, again, takes another shift, because the narrator says, "Instead, you ask your mum for an advance on your allowance." and with the money you get 3 more Taylor Swifts. So hold up, this is also a, what, teenager?
Yeah, I don't know.
Who is ordering these clones around, who is really fancying this neighbor, Tina, and Tina's having sex with all of the clones. So the values of this community, of this society that we're in, are also kind of aligning themselves differently to potentially the world that we live in.
I don't like it. If I've already made that clear. I mean, I feel unsettled. I don't like that our narrator, who we don't know the gender of the narrator, we don't know really anything about the narrator throughout the whole story, is immediately sadistic, is making the Taylor Swift do all the chores, getting more Taylor Swifts. And then when they arrive, it says, when they arrive, you make them do nothing but cardio and kickboxing training for weeks on end and steroids. They look all sweaty and hard and sexy. But unlike some people, you know all about delayed gratification. You make your Taylor Swifts sleep in separate crates.
Taylor, in a crate.
It really elicits pretty strong reactions out of me. Because I didn't know why he was doing that at this point in the story. I don't know why he's buffing up his Taylor Swifts. But it also is bringing out immediately to me the way that women's images are commodified and sold, especially Taylor Swift. I mean, especially Taylor Swift. Some of her biggest kind of controversies, or the things she's known most for in her career, are things like when her entire music collection was bought out from under her by Scooter Braun, and she no longer owned the rights to her own music. And that feels like relatable to this, where her image, her genetics, or whatever these clones are, is being taken from her and immediately abused, and other people are benefiting. And there's other examples that we'll get into in her career. And so as I'm reading this, I'm like, I don't like this. I don't like this, that women can be bought, that women can be abused, and that celebrity plays into all of this.
Yeah, the commodification is really scary, and it's really exposed here in this alternative world that we live in. We are recording this it's February 2024 when we're recording this, and it was just a few days ago last week that deepfake pornographic videos of Taylor Swift were shared online. So they were created, and then I was reading rereading the articles about it, and it said that trolls flooded the internet with these deepfakes. So even the very idea that you could take possession of Taylor Swift's face, her body, have sex with it, use them any way you want, that's happening. That's happening now in 2024, and it's happened before, but because of the incredible speed of the development of AI recently, the deep fakes are really convincing. Their regulation is really nowhere. So the deepfakes and the artificial intelligence is like rapidly outstripping any ability that, you know, we have to stop or safeguard the platforms where it could be shared. So again, this story is bringing to light the really horrible part of humanity that could say, I wanna take this celebrity, this meaningless celebrity that you don't know, and commodify them, buy and sell them, use their body, use their image, however I want, sexually, anything, and don't need to ever consider that celebrity is a human. That's why it's clever, this story of talk so much about these clones, and sort of dehumanizes them almost entirely until the end.
Yeah. And it was written almost 10 years ago. And she is still at the forefront of pop culture, but still being sexualized and commodified, like all women in the public eye are. And Taylor Swift is just the lightning rod for that.
Yeah.
What really blows my mind is the timeline of these deep fake images. They started, or this real kind of avalanche started with one anonymous guy on X, formerly Twitter, tweeting something like, "When I see Taylor Swift on TV at the NFL, this is all I see." And then these like highly graphic pictures of her in Kansas City Chief colors. And that tweet got 20.5 million views. And it came from 4chan, like the worst place in the world on the internet. And then the next day, Taylor Swift fans, Swifties, were battling back on X, trying to bury those images by posting clips of her in concert, other things, and tagging it as Taylor AI to try to bury those and protect her. And then the next day, January 23rd, there was already talk in Congress about, do we need new laws to protect against AI? And this guy said that as long as his real name, the guy who tweeted, as long as his real name and address weren't leaked, he'd be fine. The next day, his name and address were leaked. And then Elon Musk actually banned the search of Taylor Swift's name on X because it was getting so massive. So it just feels like, although these aren't clones of Taylor Swift that people can buy, it's still the parallels to the story right now are really unsettling. And we're only in the second paragraph.
What I find interesting about what is set up in this story, though, is that it's the connection between the narrator and Tina, which is what the narrator really wants. So there's a real tension between what you're describing of this kind of really dystopian, inhuman world that's created with the Taylor Swift clones, which our narrator is fully complicit in and really cruel, actually, in their behavior. But that's not the human kind of thrust. It's not the cruelty of this story and the kind of horror of all of that in relation to Taylor Swift is not the kind of heart of the story. The reason that the narrator has the clones seems to be so that he can then call up Tina, their best friend, and say, "Let's have a party where we bring all of our Taylor Swift clones together and then we can hang out." And as soon as they have this party, they obviously go upstairs and start fooling around or having sex or whatever. Just the narrator and Tina. So they get just the thing that they want. And it's an interesting tension to have that right up against this Taylor Swift dystopia where you can do anything you want to these clones and get away with it and just buy some more with your allowance.
Yeah. And we have this image when after they're starting to have the party, the Taylor Swifts are all naked, getting tan. They all look so sweet and lazy. And Tina says, "Well, what shall we do with all these Taylor Swifts? You look at her. She's just glowing. You've never wanted to be with anyone else but her in your entire life. And there goes your plan to have all your Taylor Swifts beat the crap out of all her Taylor Swifts. Let's go to your room," you tell her. "There's something I want to show you." I assume the narrator's male, which we can get into. There's no telling, but that's my assumption. It's my personal assumption. That's why he was having them kickboxing and cardio and giving them steroids, was to prepare for a fight with Tina's Taylor Swifts. And just like you said, it's not about these Taylor Swifts. It's about a way for our narrator to get closer to Tina. It's a way for them to connect.
And it just made me feel a little bit sad and a little bit nostalgic, because how am I gonna impress this person who lives next door to me, who I really like? Oh, she's really into Taylor Swift. Like, in my head, it's like, bring her a tape. Like, what is it, you know? Like, where is our like analog world gone where you'd make someone like a mixtape, or you would like want to sort of see if you can buy them something that has like the Taylor, like a Taylor Swift whatever t-shirt on, or show interest in their interests? I mean, the narrator is just showing interest in her interests.
Yeah.
But to do that, the narrator's bought all of these Taylor Swift clones and like being mean to them and they're sleeping in crates and I miss the cassette tape.
Yeah. It's so bizarre. It's so bizarre. And I keep thinking, like, it reads like extreme fan behavior almost, or like the story even reads like fan fiction or something, where at the heart of it is our pop icon, our Taylor Swift. But it's not about that at all. It's about love. It's about crushes. It's about sex. But I cannot ignore our abused clones.
And our narrator doesn't let us ignore them, because they go off and like start fooling around upstairs. And then for the first time, I think we shift into the perspective of the clones at the end. Mm-hmm. And what the writer leaves us with is the perspective of the clones. So they can't let us forget them.
Yeah. He says, a little later, the Taylor Swift smile as they hear the two of you. The one with wings stretches and practices her nightingale routine. She knows that one day the real Taylor Swift will see the videos she uploaded, and the videos will be so beautiful, so perfect, that the real Taylor Swift will send her limo driver to pick her up and take her to the real Taylor Swift's tower in New York City, where at last she too will be loved.
So she's looking for love. The clone. These clones who are being sexually abused and physically abused and kept in crates and sold again and again and again. Ugh.
It's so sad. It's like searching for salvation. And it makes me so sad. I think I feel unsettled and weird after this story. And when we reread it, I was reading the comments from Steve Almond, who is a famous writer. He was the judge of the 2015 Bartholomew Prize. And some of his descriptions of why he chose this story stood out to me. And I want to talk to you about them, because they're a very different experience than I had of reading the story. So Steve Almond's comments about this story are, full disclosure, I tried quite hard to resist choosing Taylor Swift as the winner of this year's Bartholomew Award. Why? Because all the stories I received were worthy, and many were more technically ambitious when it came to language and form, by which I guess I mean experimental. Also because I feared Taylor Swift, as an idol of consumption, might not age well, that she might not be saved from drowning as readily as Robert Kennedy. Finally, and most crucially, because I feared selecting a story entitled Taylor Swift might speak to my literary deficiencies or plain old drooling idiocy. And I don't know, Jen. I just feel like that's really interesting, because at the heart of Steve Almond's comments are that he thinks the subject of Taylor Swift is not literary enough, and that having the words Taylor Swift in the story might not be revered as high enough literature. What did you think about that?
That is so interesting. Just the idea that this story isn't ambitious because... yeah, it centers around Taylor Swift. I think you're absolutely right that that is fascinating, but also so reductive.
Yep.
Of not only the work of this writer, who has written a really compelling, weird, challenging story in this tiny, bite-sized piece of flash fiction, but also of Taylor Swift, who is... you know, an artist and a creative person and a business person. And I think so often we reduce women's success and also artists' success as less than, especially now. I mean, she's just one of the most successful, richest people in the world. She's an incredible businesswoman. She's obviously an incredible kind of visionary, like, brand person, because she's kind of built this incredible status around herself whilst maintaining a really authentic connection with her fans. I mean, I'm not sure about that comment.
I didn't like it. And I mean, I, as a Taylor Swift fan, have always been suspect of, bless her heart, but Taylor's feminism. She's a real first wave feminist. Sometimes I feel like her feminism and her advocation for the queer community can be super performative. And I think there's absolutely valid criticisms about Taylor as a person in those ways. And she's very visible, especially because now she's dating the quarterback of a football team headed to the Super Bowl. She's everywhere. So it's hard to think of her as, you know, a victim or someone who's not succeeding, when obviously she is. But then these deepfake images came out, and I was reminded again that no matter how powerful women get, and as you know, she's a white woman too, like she has every advantage, but no matter how powerful women get, people are trying to sexualize and degrade them. And the focus isn't on her music, her lyricism, her business savvy. It's on her sexuality and debasing it. And I just feel like Steve Almond's comments are not leaning into that. He's not talking about that, but also saying that Taylor Swift isn't serious and isn't a serious force. You can say what you want. You can have your own opinion about her as an artist, but she's successful and she's a lasting force.
And I think that this writer chose Taylor Swift as the heart of this story in some ways. I'm also curious about that because in some ways this writer is doing what you're saying, debasing, sexualizing, over-sexualizing, hyper-sexualizing Taylor Swift. There are multiple Taylor Swifts. They are being used and abused primarily sexually. That's like one of the first things we learn or we witness. And that is challenging to me. When I was reading it, I was like, oh, I don't know. Like, I kind of hate that this is happening. But because of its relevance to now, I'm like, it's so important that we kind of see and analyze and have a lens by which we can kind of step back and through this story go, this is bringing out the worst in us. This is bringing out the worst in Tina. It brings out the worst in the narrator, having these Taylor Swifts. So there's also that perspective, which I wonder if the writer was trying to bring as he chose Taylor Swift for this story.
I think you're right, yeah, because her name is very ubiquitous. Her brand is very ubiquitous, even back in 2015, which was right after she'd released 1989, which was a huge success. You know, people know, by choosing Taylor Swift, people know what she looks like. They know at this point in time, you know, she's known for writing songs about her ex-boyfriends. She's just switched from country to pop. She's a known entity that people can kind of place their own desires and wishes and worst traits onto. Which brings me back to the second part of Steve Almond's comments that I wanted to get your reaction on. He talks more about why he chose this story, but then he says, Taylor Swift is also, not incidentally, funny as hell. I read it to my wife. I read it to my 9-year-old daughter. I read it to my neighbor. I walked outside my little house and stood on the soggy steps and sang the words out to the stupid birds in the trees. I didn't think it was funny. Maybe I don't have a sense of humor. I didn't think it was funny.
I mean, I guess some of the way that it's written, there's some sort of almost like punchlines in the story because of the rhythm of the language, because of the kind of absurdity. I do feel like there is the rhythm, which I think could be interpreted as sort of trying to make jokes. But I didn't find it funny either. I mean, I sort of feel like that rhythm of the writing is part of the way that the writer is kind of creating the world and this teenage voice of the narrator. But no, I didn't find it funny.
I think the absurdity of it, like you're talking about, the rhythm of it, you know, the first sentence is a great example of that. You're in love. It's great. You swipe on your phone and order. The next day, a Taylor Swift clone shows up at your house. Like, whoa, where am I? What's happening? Like, that part is funny. But I just can't get over these clones being in, like, put in separate crates, being forced to exercise. And I know it's all absurd, but something about it doesn't make me laugh. I'll say that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a line. So Tina says, passing you the apple, what should we do with all these Taylor Swifts? It's the absurdity that I can imagine. Like, it brings a lightness in the writing because we've got these two teenagers who are like, what's happening here? Like, what are we going to, what's happening? You know, and I feel like that is there. But I agree that it wasn't like, I'm going to go tell my neighbor. I mean, I've recently moved into an apartment. I don't know my neighbors that well. Can you imagine? Is this the right opener?
This absurdist, realish piece of short fiction?
As I'm like checking my phone notes app to work to remember their name.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to be too serious about it because I know that it's supposed to bring out reactions. It's absurdity. It's supposed to make you think about technology and fame and celebrity. But I'm just trying to notice my own reactions to it.
Oh, yeah. I was mad. I would say I read the story and felt mad.
And I think probably alongside with these AI images coming out, it's just like, holy shit, we're closer to this than we think. And, you know, I want to go back to that article by Brandon Williams, where he was talking about this story. And he says, how you read the story, the literal reading experience as you move through the paragraphs, hinges on what you had previously thought of those Taylor Swifts. And he means the clones. And thus, it becomes a story about your own reading experience, and to a certain extent, a question of your own morality. Were they real to you the entire time? We weren't inside their heads, so we couldn't know until the end how to treat them, and yet we had to choose to treat them from our first moment. Where was your interest, your empathy? And once the truth is revealed, what do you think of yourself and your choices? This process of self-reflection is only possible because the story refuses to let you inside these characters.
Oh, I love that. I hope we pass the moral test.
I hope so too. And I did like that his focus was not on Taylor Swift, the person, the celebrity, but actually on the clone and this like kind of empty character we're given and who until the end, we don't really know what their interior life is.
Thank you for reading with me, Lizzie.
Thanks for reading with me, Jen.